Tom Woods Show, episode 1891.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here, talking to Tho Bishop today, who is assistant editor over at the Mises Wire, which is a great blog you can check out over at the Mises Institute website, Mises.org, M-I-S-E-S.org. And he is really an up-and-coming commentator. He's one of these people who, when he writes something, I sit up and pay attention. And he's been writing about, well, the kinds of challenges that those of us with dissident voices are facing in the current climate. And we got to figure out what kind of response is there. Is there a good, robust, libertarian response? What really should we be doing? And what should we be avoiding? So that's the kind of conversation I want to have. Tho, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
You recently ran a piece that Lou Rockwell picked up. You ran it over on Mises.org on the blog, I guess, about what's going on with the right wing and how it's in the crosshairs of the current regime. So let's pull that apart a little bit. Let's start with, now that we've had just about 4 months now to look at what happened on January 6th, can you give us a non-hysterical recap of that?
Well, my analysis is that it was not 9/11. And this is instantly against the narrative that the Beltway has been pounding the table on ever since it happened, right? You know, what you had was a large rally of Trump supporters. Some of them got into the Capitol. It seemed like many of them were invited in by police. And now they have used this as, they kept looking for exactly this sort of excuse to, I think, escalate using the powers of the federal regime against these voters that dared, went against their plans, right? And what made Trump so interesting politically was never his policy. I mean, you know, a lot of it was lackluster. A lot of the people that really care about his stuff were kind of left disappointed. In many ways, that might not have been a bad thing in some of the ways that some of the things he campaigned on. But what was always interesting was that he represented genuine anger and hostility from your average Republican voter. And it's been remarkable the last 4 years dealing with, you know, normal, you know, non-Ron Paul Republicans here in the Florida Panhandle, how much they kind of sound like us now. And so, guy, I think that, you know, this moment's very interesting because January 6th kind of gave DC all of the excuse that it needed to escalate cracking down on a certain portion of the public that they dislike. And, you know, the article recently on The Wire was focused on the case of Nick Fuentes, who's a controversial kind of right-wing social media pundit. I'm not going to get into Nick Fuentes himself, but it appears that he was placed on a no-fly list. And what was interesting is that while it's not clear what the underlying cause is, that he wasn't given a letter from the TSA explaining it, right? That's never how it works. It was interesting to me, like, how many people were trying to imply that it would be surprising if this was the case. And obviously, like, this makes all the sense in the world, right? I mean, there's never been any due process involved with any war on terror style tactic, right? You know, that was never an issue. And we should expect, I think, this sort of treatment going forward for a lot of the very public and pronounced Trump base, because again, that is where there's a lot of a bipartisan anger against that portion of the American populace.
Well, for what it's worth, I don't favor using that kind of measure against people I oppose. So I don't favor it against Nick Fuentes or against, well, the 99% of the public I can't stand. Just kidding. But you know what I mean? I would not cheer if this were used against some. I mean, I don't even think about Nick Fuentes one way or the other.
Right.
But I do think day to day about crazy people who are destroying society. And I wouldn't want this used against them either. I don't want their podcasts taken down. I don't want YouTube censoring them either, because I just think that's a bad way for a society to be run. So I have this crazy old-fashioned view that nobody should do any of these things. Now, it would be nice if we could all just agree on that. But unfortunately, it seems like when the balance of power shifts, the rhetoric about fairness and, you know, let 100 flowers bloom and this and that, that just goes by the wayside. Once we get enough power, we all see that was just a smokescreen to get us into this position so that we can do the things we actually want to do.
Right. I mean, for all the language that came out during early days of the Biden administration about unity and moving past, I mean, what we've seen is that the Biden regime is off to a far more radical start than anything that we saw in the Obama era. And I think that it has less to do with, obviously, the personalities involved in that. Biden isn't running the Biden administration, right? Very rarely is that case in any presidency. Nothing particularly unique to Biden necessarily. But he is clearly not the intellectual powerhouse behind everything going on. But your average Biden staffer is far to the left of your average Obama staffer, just because how crazy this world's gone in the last 5 years, or much further than that if you go to the first term of Obama administration. And I think that's one of the interesting things as well, is that we've kind of moved on, not to the extent that we like, obviously, with now kind of the process of withdrawing from Afghanistan. There's a lot of war on terror battlefields out there with a lot of human toil. But I think that the kind of the Beltway consensus is kind of moving past that now. And they're looking, the domestic terrorism right now is now the big boogeyman for the regime. And of course, it's appropriate now with CIA propaganda videos promoting intersectionality and, all those tropes on the left. This is something that conservative America needs to really take very seriously. And the good thing is, I think they are. I think a lot of Republicans in their gut, they might not be used to thinking of themselves as enemies of the state, but I think they kind of realize that they are enemies of the regime that currently exists in Washington. And that's something that gives me optimism, trying to communicate good Rothbardian sort of ideas out there. Because again, they're a lot more defensive, I think, of what it really means to have a federal government controlled by an alternative party than perhaps they have in the past.
I noticed that you seem to be following Ron DeSantis pretty closely, correct?
Yes.
Did you follow? Because I haven't, so I'm going to rely on you. And if the answer is no, we'll move on to another topic. But this whole matter of social media deplatforming in Florida, If so, can you tell us, what did that consist of?
Yes, the bill is interesting because one of the things I liked about it is, I say, the entire discussion about social media censorship, I think there's a lot of fixation has been on a national scale on the Section 230 stuff. And I think it's a really bad way of trying to address this this larger problem like corporate neoliberalism, right? And one of the things that hasn't helped the quote-unquote libertarian cause here is that there's a lot of Beltway libertarians that seem to have just relished every time like someone like Alex Jones gets banned, like they're giddy about it, right? So they're celebrating what is illiberal corporate practices, regardless of the private public distinction there. In the case of Florida, though, it's the legislation that was actually passed was far more narrow. In fact, there was a lot of complaints about it. The Nick Fuentes thing, he learned that he was on a no-fly list because he was trying to fly down to Florida for a protest, basically accusing this bill of not being harsh enough against big tech. And there's some validity to it. I mean, the scope of this bill is that it's focused on limiting deplatforming of politicians. Okay, right? It was directly kind of a Donald Trump, Florida man sort of move there. And DeSantis trying to strengthen his relationship with the resident of Mar-a-Lago. And then it also has some consumer protections, or at least that's the wording that they would use, that would require social media platforms to provide kind of an advance warning about deplatforming and kind of require them to be more transparent in the process they use for deplatforming average people. And so in both those things, it is this is the state of Florida trying to dictate certain business practices to these large corporations. One thing that's kind of interesting is that Florida politics, one of the biggest power brokers is Disney, and Disney got a full exemption in this bill because of the way that the sausage is made in politics. But it's a relatively modest approach relative to some of those larger conversations about, Republican going after big tech. Really, it has to do with candidates specifically, politicians specifically, and a little bit more transparency side on terms of how normal users might get platformed going forward.
I want to read a fairly lengthy excerpt from a piece that Jeff Deist wrote a few weeks ago. You may know the piece I have in mind, talking about big tech and evolving common law as a way of dealing with different circumstances. Rather than having some bureaucracy overseeing it and coming up with rules, the way society evolved in the past when technology would change and circumstances would change is that the law would gradually evolve to reflect the new circumstances. Mm-hmm. So let me just take a moment to read this, and I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/1891. Okay, here we go. Longstanding legal concepts like equitable estoppel, conversion, fraud, and waiver are available and malleable. Libertarian legal theory, rooted in natural law, property, and restitution, relies on common law discovery rather than positive law edicts. Ever-evolving common law, highly temporalized and localized, provides the best mechanism for determining what actions by tech companies should give rise to legal liability. Stealing a horse in 1800s Tombstone, Arizona, is different from stealing a horse in 2021 Middleburg, Virginia. The former may have left the victim dead in the desert and the perpetrator ordered whipped by an exceedingly unsympathetic jury. Today, deplatforming a celebrity from social media or unbanking a small business owner may leave them metaphorically stranded in the desert. In both cases, societal and technological evolution should compel us to adjust our ideas of harm and proportionality. Shouldn't common law, rather than rigid and highly political statutory or regulatory frameworks, give us better outcomes? I got a few more paragraphs, but they're worth every word because they give rise to important questions. He says, the larger question for libertarians is whether their existing conceptions of property rights, harms, torts, and free speech still work in a thoroughly digital era. Principles may not change, but facts and circumstances certainly do. Rothbard's strict paradigm for what ought to constitute actionable force, especially as discussed in Part 2 of The Ethics of Liberty, requires some kind of physical invasion of person or property. In doing so, Rothbard necessarily distinguishes between aggression, legally actionable, and the broader idea of harm. The former gives rise to tort liability in Rothbardian/libertarian law. The latter is part of the vicissitudes of life and must be endured. Theorists like Professor Walter Block and Stefan Kinsella have expanded on this physical invasion rule, applying it to everything from blackmail to defamation to so-called intellectual property. Aggression against physical persons or property creates a legally actionable claim. Mere harm does not. But Rothbard's bright line rule seems unsatisfying in our digital age. If anything, the complexity of modern information technology and the pace of innovation make the case against bright line tests. For one thing, the sheer scale of instantaneous information ought to inform our view of aggression versus harm. A single false tweet stating, "Famous person X is a pedophile," could reach hundreds of millions of people in a day, ruining X's life forever. This is a bit worse than a punch to X's nose in a bar fight, to put it mildly. Moreover, physical trespass against property takes on an entirely different form when said property is intangible, e.g. Twitter's platform and servers. There's a difference, at least in scale, between Donald Trump occupying a tiny sliver of data storage at almost no additional marginal cost to Twitter, and Donald Trump occupying the lobby at Twitter's headquarters. Again, surely the best argument is to let naturally evolving common law grapple with these questions. Yes, we don't have private common law courts, and yes, we have a gargantuan statutory overlay at both the federal and state levels, but we ought to argue for the underlying principle of evolving discovered law and advocate for legislatures to get out of the way of private litigating parties and juries. And then finally, common law tort and contract doctrines, not a hopelessly befuddled Congress or agency bureaucrats, can regulate big tech. But libertarians and conservatives should broaden their conceptions of tort and contract remedies and support the evolution of what constitutes harm in a digital era. Private companies, quote-unquote, that openly deplatform, impoverish, and unperson dissident voices are waging a war of attrition. Those inclined to fight back should look to courts rather than legislatures, and they don't need novel legal theories to do so. Common law, tort, and contract will do just fine. All right, I'm sorry for taking so long on that, but I read that and it hit me kind of like a thunderbolt.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of what Jeff is saying there?
I think that when he started bringing this up, I know him and Alan Mendenhall have been looking at this. And to me, like I think it's just fascinating stuff. Now, obviously, I work for the Mises Institute. You know, I have a career interest in saying nice things about Jeff. But like, this is exactly why, you know, I read everything that Jeff Dice writes. Because, you know, for what it kind of ties into, I think, his larger political views on just kind of skepticism of political universalism, which I think is often kind of a trap that some libertarians fall into. And I think this is exactly the sort of, you know, I think it's a fascinating approach to this subject, which I do think is an issue, right? I think when libertarians just take a very, you know, like, oh, well, it's just the private company and dismiss all the concerns out there about what this actually means in a society, you're missing some real harm going on here. And I think the Florida approach here is along these lines. Like, I know in the past, Jeff has talked about, you know, again, while yes, you know, you opt in with terms of services with these big tech platforms, that, you know, there's a certain extent where if you are arbitrarily enforcing these contracts and you don't have any sort of, you as a consumer have no idea of how to expect these things to be enforced going forward. Like, that there's common law issues that have been raised in the past and in other areas. And I think that, you know, particularly the recognizing how big this is and the deplatforming the digital age, this is something else that, you know, when people here have talked about, and I know like the vaccine passport issue, right? Another thing where, you know, it's there's libertarians that have raised concerns about a state like Florida preventing businesses from using vaccine passports if they want to with their normal interactions with customers. Here too, you have an issue where, you know, people are recognizing that this sets the stage for something a lot more dangerous, right? This is a very authoritarian measure. And we've seen how things like debanking has been used as a political weapon against, you know, everything from, you know, right-wing pundits to gun manufacturers, given enough political pressure. And so that disconnect of the politics of corporate America and the politics of the regime, particularly right now, it requires more than I think some of the black and white go-to libertarian thought in the past. And I think someone like Rothbard, you know, obviously any time where you have someone from the Mises Institute offering a different perspective than Rothbard on libertarian legal theory, that's a big deal. But I think it's something that I've been reading a lot of his work in the 90s. And I think that Rothbard would fully have appreciated, you know, just how dangerous this sort of environment is. And again, I think Jeff's perspective here, particularly given his legal background, adds a lot more to the occasion than you're going to get from a lot of other libertarian alleged advocacy outfits out there.
Well, another reason that it's tone deaf simply to say such and such is a private company is that we can criticize private companies. We can say this private company is contributing to a culture that's going to yield a society nobody would want to live in.
Right.
And private actors can do that just as much as state actors can do it. And now sometimes they say politics is downstream of culture. I'm not sure I believe that, by the way. I actually think politics in some ways drives culture. But let's say that commonplace is true. Then there should be all the more reason to be concerned about allegedly private actors behaving in this way because, well, maybe people get accustomed to seeing people with dissident voices silenced, and then it you know, politics is downstream of that. And before you know it, It's a state measure that's doing these sorts of things to people. So maybe we just want to nip it in the bud by speaking up and saying, this is not the kind of company we want to patronize. This is not the kind of society we want. And not to mention, this is not like one little company made one little decision. This is a group of companies. This is a cultural force whereby certain sorts of voices get silenced and certain sorts of voices either are left alone or are amplified. We can't sit and pretend that this is just, well, Dairy Queen decided to drop the butterscotch coating. And so, you know, you guys got to live with that. No, this is contributing potentially to the creation of a society that, let's just say at the very least, a lot of us would not want to live in. So if this is the canary in the coal mine, we want to point to it. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously this is something that you know, Michael Malice and others have talked about, but you know, one of the biggest disrupting forces of the kind of the control of the regime has been the fact that it is far more difficult for the state to manufacture the narrative the way it has been in the past, right? Social media disrupted the reliable control of information from the media, the corporate press, even one where, you know, just if you think about like the Iraq War, right? And you had the run-up dominated cable news alongside of the major three networks, alongside of conservative talk radio, right? So all those alternatives out there were all kind of brought in. Social media, you know, prevented alternatives to consuming that nonstop feed of propaganda. And this is exactly why they recognize how dangerous, you know, why there's a deliberate attempt here to again, align the interest of big tech and a certain political ideology. And we can't be blind to that fact. And then also, of course, a lot of these corporate actors, you know, while I think it's easy at times to perhaps overstate direct connections there. I mean, these are corporations that did not emerge organically from a free market, right? We're living in an interventionist economy on both from the impact of the central banks and regulatory agencies and different federal laws and like regulations that go into all this sort of stuff. And so again, we can't just simply, I think, box ourselves and you know, not recognize a threat that's right in front of us And that is a major threat to the ability of having a free society in the first place.
Hey, folks, I want to take a quick minute to thank our sponsor and talk to you about cryptocurrency. If you've been wanting to invest in cryptocurrency but don't know where to start, or you found it difficult to sift through the mountains of information out there to find the good stuff, or you've been watching the price shoot up and you think, I've missed the boat. Well, according to my good friend and repeat Tom Woods Show guest, John Bush, if you think you've missed the boat, well, he's got good news for you. The sales aren't even set and there's still time to get involved. To help you get started, he's put together an online course called Demystifying Crypto, How to Buy, Hold, spelled the crazy way, of course, and Multiply Your Cryptocurrency. So check it out at cryptoandprivacy.com. This two-day interactive course will help you gain the knowledge necessary to safely buy and securely hold your cryptocurrency. We've all heard horror stories of the poor sap who can't find his password and loses access to millions worth of Bitcoin. Don't be that guy. And to round it all out, they're offering a bonus section on internet privacy. So if you're tired of big tech snooping around your digital life like a nosy parent, the workshop will teach you browsing habits to hide your digital footprint and how to send and receive encrypted messages that even Big Brother can't read. So you don't want to miss this informative and interactive virtual workshop John and his team are hosting. And get this, John is guaranteeing that if you take the workshop, you will go from crypto curious to crypto confident in one weekend, or they'll give you your money back, no questions asked. So to learn more or reserve your ticket today, go to cryptoandprivacy.com. That's cryptoandprivacy.com. I want to take the rest of the time to ask you about what you've been up to politically, your own activities in your own local area, and not so much the specific issues that you've been dealing with, but your overall strategy. Your view is that for whatever its faults, and they are many, the Republican Party has to be the way to go because it has an infrastructure, it has donors lists, it has name recognition, it has a brand, it has all these sorts of things institutionally that no challenger really has. And so, yeah, you have to deal with really, really loathsome people. That's true. You also have to deal with loathsome people in the Libertarian Party.
Yes.
So your approach has been, now I talk a lot about the Libertarian Party on this show, and I want to be as fair-minded as possible. So I think I know what your case is, but make it anyway.
Well, one of the things that, I've always been getting a lot more interested in politics than most Rothbardians should be, right? It's perhaps one of my larger vices. But really this past year kind of radicalized me on the importance of getting serious about political strategy because, you know, again, it was less than 33,000 votes is responsible for us as Floridians being among the freest people on the planet this past year, right? And I don't take that lightly. Like, I can't fathom living in a lockdown state. And I was protected from it, again, because of vulgar blue versus red politics. And the reality is that, you know, the structure that we have, you know, within the American government, better for worse, it's a two-party system. And it has been from the very beginning. Now, parties can change, right? But they do that by taking over, you know, they don't disrupt the duopoly. They take over one side of the pendulum. And I that's why I think, like, right now, you know, when you see typical politics, right, I think people get so fixated on the politicians, and most of the politicians are total scumbags, right? Outside of, you know, maybe 10 Republicans in Congress, I wouldn't want to be seen. You know, I wouldn't want to shake hands with most of the people in D.C. from the party that I represent, or the party that I'm a member of. But the average Republican voter, I have a lot more faith in the average Republican voter than I do your average Libertarian, and obviously far more than I do in the left, because the conversations, again, they recognize that the whole meme about how, like, you know, Donald Trump, you know, they're not after me, they're after you, I'm standing in their way. Again, like, the whole aesthetics of Trump are so much better than Trump stuff. I think it's Lou Rockwell said, you know, the Jeffersonians are better than Jefferson, the Taftians are better than Taft, and the Trumpers are better than Trump. Like, I believe that sincerely. And so I think that now's the time more than ever, and particularly as Rothbardians, I think we have something unique to add to this larger right-wing populist moment. And I think it's a huge mistake not to take advantage of it, because we have a lot of the answers that the right needs. Every time I see Tucker Carlson rail about, you know, vulture capitalism and not mention the Fed, I want, you know, to tear my hair out, right? It's because he gets so close. There's a lot of his analysis on the inherent corruption of, you know, obviously he's fantastic on the war issue. He's fantastic on the deep state in general. He's fantastic at naming a lot of the worst actors. But if you're simply going to rail against trade and ignore the Fed, then you're missing a major piece. And I think this is where we have such a great opportunity as people that understand, you know, because, you know, obviously, you know, the brand of libertarianism that I find most compelling is the one that doesn't see us as atomized individuals, that recognizes the importance of culture and community and family. And, you know, a lot of the stuff that Mises writes about, hey, this isn't just, you know, Rothbard, you know, going, trying to appeal to Buchanan voters in the 90s, right? There's a long, long intellectual tradition of this. And now's the time for us, I think, that we can really have a moment here to interject our ideas into that conversation on the right. And you can only do that. They will only listen to you, particularly in this polarized age, if you're part of the tribe. And so if the more that we can get people familiar with Mises and Rothbard, engaging as fellow Republicans in this larger intellectual debate, I think the better off we're going to be as an intellectual movement. And I think that there is reason to believe that there is the potential for these ideas to resonate with voters in a way that can result in meaningful political victories. And that's what Young Americans for Liberty was doing, stacking the base with state legislators, right? We're now again, once again, in this moment where state rights and nullification are coming up in normal conversations with Republicans, because that's what happens when you don't own the White House, right? I was at a CD2 caucus meeting here in Florida. I was at RPOF quarterly this past weekend, and like 70% of the conversation when, you know, a bunch of people in the panhandle were together was the necessity of nullification, if not the necessity of secession, if Democrats pass HR 1, which is their voter integrity law. Like, this is a normal conversation we were having. That's what gets me so excited. And that's why, like, now's like the worst time possible to perhaps to try to, in my opinion, try to act above the left-right split. Because ultimately, I think it's the culture war issues are our greatest asset. Like, being able to take a side and have common bonds with a lot of these people on the non-explicit ideological stuff, I think that's a real asset there. And of course, again, in Florida, I think here in Florida, you have someone like Ron DeSantis, who is one of the few politicians ever that I've seen actually substantially improve. Like, I think his understanding of the dangers of kind of those non-state centers of power, right? Like, he understands DC policy experts are full of crap after COVID. He understands the media is dishonest, right? That's, you know, check, check. And he understands, a lot of his policy stance have been getting leftist indoctrination out of you know, fighting a lot of that baked in the public education system, you know, things like the big tech stuff and things like that. And again, so here's someone, here you actually have the most popular Republican in the country right now, perhaps, and second to Trump, who is an obvious ally to a lot of our desired end goals. So that's why I think this moment's really interesting. And the other side of it is that if we aren't out there engaging that, then there's a lot of aspects in this national populist right that I think are inherently illiberal. And so if we don't engage with them, then they have a lot more ability to impose their ideologies in the conversations of the right. And so that's another reason why I think we need to be in that arena. Because if we lose the right, like the left is gone. The left has been totally taken over by crazies. If we also lose, if the American right also becomes just as illiberal, then we're going to be much worse off as libertarians than we have been. And at a time where Republicans actually cared at times to make perhaps meaningless gestures, but gestures at all at us in the first place.
Well, I'll be honest with you. There are moments of frustration in which, in my mind, I wrestle with some of the ideas that some of the nationalist right is putting out there. And by nationalist, by the way, everybody's a nationalist in America, basically, with the exception of those of us who favor secession. I mean, the neocons are all nationalists in their own way. But I'm thinking in terms of Trumpian-style nationalism.
Right.
And the kind of argument I used to make against those people, one of them would be the kinds of powers you grab for yourselves now, mm-hmm. you don't want to see them in the hands of people who despise you. But the problem with that argument is the people who despise you don't need any precedents. They're not exercising powers because some Republican president did it first and now they're going to turn. They're going to exercise power no matter what. So I could imagine a nationalist sort of conservative coming back at me and saying, look, Mr. Libertarian, who's so self-satisfied with his principles, you can stand there and defend your abstract principles. The left is going to defend itself and its ideas, and it's going to ram them down our throats. Now, if your contribution to the conversation is to say, well, we should all just have principles and leave everybody alone and just be nice to everybody, then you're going to get swept away by people who have actual substantive things to say. So when we get power, No, our job isn't going to be, well, gee, we better relinquish as much of this as possible so that the left doesn't grab it. The left will grab it no matter what we do. We should use that power to make sure that people with sensible ideas are in charge of things and people with crazy ideas are out on their ear. And we should use that power to mold society in the way we want it, because the left has channeled everything against us and has created a society that we all feel like strangers in. And we better use federal power, not run away from it, to fight back. Is there a do you have a temptation in that direction? And secondly, if the answer is no, how do you answer people who talk that way?
No, I mean, it's definitely tempting at times because, again, there are aspects, and this has come up a lot with looking at DeSantis and having a lot of appreciation for his policies. I mean, this is something I had to weigh because, I mean, some of the stuff that made DeSantis's COVID stuff so effective was explicitly him disallowing local governments from putting in place a lot of the stronger COVID-related stuff that we've seen around the country. Like he preempted the local stuff. And again, as someone who has always been, you know, favored out of decentralization, you know, down to the individual level if possible, right? To use the Mises quote, you know, it's like, how do I defend that? And I can kind of rationalize it my own way. It's like, oh, well, ultimately they're having to use state enforcement agents, state in the actual Florida sense, not in the government sense. They're having to use state resources for it. And so perhaps there's an argument there, why yada, yada, yada. But ultimately it's just, I like it because the end result is more liberty and I like more liberty. And again, as I understand that, that can lead to a lot of inconsistencies and some slippery slope arguments, right? Again, but as you said, we're all, for one, like the American political system, our system of governance is not consistent in any degree, right? I mean, it's full of contradictions and hypocrisies. And you know, we have Obamacare, for example, still exists only because you had Supreme Court judges acting explicitly like politicians rather than actually considering the merits of legal arguments and things like that, right? So we need to stop pretending as if any system that is less than, you know, an inherently consistent thing, it is valuable to liberty. Now, if you allow a state like Florida to, you know, overrule the ability of a large corporation to use vaccine passports, can that be used in ways that I don't like? Okay, sure. That's why we need to make sure that the government is as aligned with us as it can be. And, you know, I know that's going to make some libertarians out there like this is going to sound like I'm just spitting, you know, bile at them. And I appreciate that. Like they have the best intentions at heart. And you know, I've been there. But it's you know, again, the events of the past year and recognizing, again, the very real impact that the state of Florida has had on me being much freer than most of humanity. You know, I can't just simply ignore that just because of my devotion to libertarian theory. And so the thing is, I think there's a lot of you know, Rothbard and Mises both were very practical men. Like they understood. I mean, you know, Rothbard's work in the 90s where he talked about, you know, hey, like you're not going to have a free society if people are afraid of walking around at night because of riots and looting and things like that, right? And so if the only system in place that is there right now to equip with providing security is government police, then obviously, again, you want to check the abuses of police. You want to try to make sure that the scope of police activity is directed purely to genuine NAP violations, right? Not white collar crime or arresting someone for insider trading or something like that, right? But you know, you're not going to simply say, hey, any attempt from the cops to use their force against people burning down buildings is bad because cops are bad, right? And so, yeah, it's something I try to gauge with seriously. It's something I don't take for granted. And so these are some of the things that I'm trying to improve my own understanding of the way the world works. And, you know, a lot of the guests that you've had in your podcast and have helped you know, inform some of my views that I have now. And so I'm very appreciative of platforms like this.
Well, thank you very much. Now, of course, we also want people to be reading what's posted over at the Mises Institute,
yes.
Mises.org, because you and I both have learned an awful lot over there. And I agree with you. I read everything Jeff writes. And Jeff is too self-deprecating. I don't think he fully appreciates how valuable and original his thoughts are and how many of us really are dying to know what he thinks about all kinds of things. And as soon as I see he has something written, I know it's going to be great. I'm probably going to agree with it. And chances are, well, there's at least a 30% chance I hadn't thought of the issue the way he describes it until I read it. And then once I read it, I'm convinced instantly. It really reminds me of when I was first getting involved in all this, and I would always wonder, I wonder what Lou Rockwell thinks about such and such. And then I would read it, and I would say, yeah, that's right. So that's kind of how I feel about Jeff, too.
Absolutely. I mean, the Institute has been so... Well, I mean, obviously, the world is just a better place off for the existence of the Institute. It's the greatest honor of my life to marrying my wife, to be able to play any small role in it. But we were just so lucky to have both Lou Rockwell and Jeff Deist, who, you know, are not, you know, PhD scholars, but are just brilliant, principled, genuine intellectual leaders at times where they've been needed. And I've had so much fun the past few months reading, you know, a lot of Lou's commentary from the 90s. And again, so much. I find myself repeating, you know, quoting Jeff Deist at normal Republican functions, perhaps more than even more than a Trump tweet, which again, I try to work in as much Trump related humor as possible. There's nothing sells better than that. So we're very, very lucky to have two thinkers like that that have done so much to inform a lot of my views.
Well, you don't have a website, but you do have a Twitter account that is worth following. I'd just like to know if people like Tho Bishop, what should they do next?
And you can find me on Twitter at Tho Bishop, T-H-O-B-I-S-H-O-P. And so I know we have a lot of people that have been looking at Florida. So if anyone is coming through the panhandle, please hit me up on Twitter and I'd be happy to buy a drink or something if you've come through this area. I offered that with the Lions of Liberty podcast. I was on there a couple of weeks ago. And not only have I had multiple people take me up on that offer, but I've had one person relocate from Wisconsin to about 15 minutes down the road right here. So the more I can do to bring in strong libertarian talent into the panhandle and make Florida even freer, that's what I'm about right now.
I hear you. All right, excellent. Well, thank you very much, Tho. I always appreciate your contributions. And, you know, when you write something, I say, I wonder what Tho thinks about this. So thanks again for your time today.
Thank you, Tom.
Okay, everybody. By the way, I have not yet announced to this podcast audience until just this moment that the website to register for the 2000th episode event, the 2000th Tom Woods Show episode event in Orlando, which is going to be an absolute blast with so many of your favorites from the Tom Woods Show, that site is now open. The event is free and open to the public, but do please register at tomwoods2000.com. It's not tomwoods.com/2000. That'll be when we have the episode. That's the page where we'll store it. But tomwoods2000.com is the website. And I want you to check that out and register and let people know about it. And if you're a member of the Supporting Listeners Program, you'll notice that you can also sign up for a reception. And if you sign up for the reception, that automatically gets you into the main event. You don't have to sign up for everything. And then there's a super duper elite reception just for people at the platinum level of support and above, where you'll actually come into the hospitality suite with us and get to mingle with all the special guests of the evening. And I'm going to have a couple of surprises for you too, in terms of guests. So those of you who are at that elite of the elite reception, you are forbidden to tell anybody who the surprise guests are. So it's going to be a ton of fun. As I say, it does not cost you one cent to attend this event. And for heaven's sake, we've had our lives disrupted, travel disrupted, our plans disrupted. Here's a chance to buck all that and get back to normal with a bang by hanging around with people whose brains have not been warped by propaganda and just have a good time like normal people for a night. So check out the details at tomwoods2000.com. Let everybody know about it, and I can't wait to see you all there, and I'll see you right here on the Tom Woods Show tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.